You're listening to Queers, a podcast about politics and culture with Simon Copland and Benjamin Riley.
It's the 18th of November 2016. I'm Simon Copland.
And I'm Benjamin Riley.
Welcome to Queers. Each episode we talk our way through questions on a theme, and this week we're talking about call-out culture.
But firstly, we'd just like to apologise for, or just even explain, the delay in the release of this episode. I just got back from a holiday in China, which meant we weren't able to record.
And then when Ben got back, I went away on holidays to Cairns and the Great Barrier Reef for a week, only returning yesterday. But now we're both back home and ready to go.
So either it's going to be really great because we're all rested, or we've actually forgotten how to do podcasts. So we'll see how we go. So to kick this off, because apparently we can't not talk about it, it's been just over a week since Donald Trump shocked the world by winning the US presidential election. One of the many reasons his win appeared so surprising is that throughout the campaign, Trump made comment after ridiculous comment denigrating a very wide range of marginalized groups.
In fact, these statements played a significant role in the campaign against Trump. Much of the election was framed around progressives calling out Trump for his sexist, homophobic and racist statements. This call-out culture has been a bit on the rise in recent years, I guess maybe particularly since the rise of social media, where individuals are singled out and attacked when they make offensive comments as a way to counteract bigotry.
The election of Donald Trump, however, has got Simon and I thinking about call-out culture and its perhaps limitations. Where does it come from, for example, and is it effective? So, Simon, to get started, why do you think Trump's offensive comments became such a focal point for so-called progressive opposition to his campaign?
Yeah, it's a good question, and I think it's one that we're going to have to reflect on sort of longer track as people sort of reflect on Donald Trump's election and, you know, why it occurred and what it means. I think, firstly, it's important to state that, I mean, a bunch of his statements were really awful, and not just awful in the sense of, I guess, you know, trying to make headlines, but generally terrible and terrifying stuff. So his in particular, I think his sort of announcement of his plan to ban Muslims from coming into the United States was a particular area of importance, largely because it wasn't just a racist comment, but was actually a policy proposal, and I think it was one worth having this huge debate about. And then the sort of grab 'em by the pussy sexual assault comments were, again, something that I think that was really important to talk about because of this, the need to have a discussion about sexual assault and sort of the growing debate around that issue. So I think firstly it's to recognise that this is an important part of the discourse, I guess.
Totally.
And I think it's worthwhile having that conversation. However, I think at the same time, a large part of this is part of a process of sort of growing identity politics process within the left or progressive, so-called, whatever, you know, however we want to define that group of people, which frames and has framed everything around identity, around people's identity as either women or people of colour or queers, and tried to frame that the entire election around that. And so you saw a debate on the left or progressive side of politics, which basically said, you know, people shouldn't vote for him because he said these awful things, and that is the sort of end of discussion. We've called him out on these awful things he said, end of discussion on that, and then people have been really shocked to see people who did vote for him and to see that message may not have necessarily worked. I think it's part of a growing trend which focuses in identity politics and focuses in on the sort of growing role of language within that process, particularly in a process of really high level of media engagement and social media engagement, where we become quite saturated with these sorts of comments all the time, and the ability to spread those comments very far and wide. It's a natural bringing together
so
identity
politics.
When you say
these comments, you mean like the kind of things
So the kind of things that Trump was saying, but I think it's not just, you know, I think, you know, and what we're trying to do here is to use Trump as an example of a sort of what I see as a growing trend of people focusing in on people saying awful things and calling out that awful things, and then stuff spreading across social media and sort of having this bit of outrage culture around this sort of stuff. So there was a lot of that around Trump, obviously, because he's, said lots of awful things. But
Sure,
you
sure.
see it around, you see it around a whole bunch of different people. I think about the example of the last year. It was the Nobel Prize laureate in who made a sexist joke about women in relation to at a science conference, and that sort of spread like wildfire, and there was this huge outrage culture around that. There's a guy who wrote a book about what was it called? It's called. So You've Been Publicly Shamed, which is
John Ronson,
this, the John
yeah.
Ronson book about people who have sort of been publicly shamed about these comments they've made, and this sort of people being called out for this stuff, and it just spreading like wildfire, and that being the focus of this outrage culture. And I think that the focus on Trump of this is sort of not the culmination, but is a perfect example of this growing culture of which is a mixture of identity politics being clashed up against social media saturation, where that's sort of how these things come about, I guess. What are
Sure.
your
I mean, I feel
thoughts?
like Trump is a kind of illustrative way to get into this too, because like a US presidential election is something that has extraordinarily wide ramifications for the world, and it's about a lot of different things. It has a very it has both very incredible kind of symbolic and material relevance to not just the US but to the world. And so I guess what I am interested in around that question is just literally imagining a person kind of sitting in front of their computer and kind of reading a news story about Trump. Like the grab them by the pussy is like a good, I think the kind of probably most illustrative example of this. And like, what makes that the kind of most urgent thing to be discussed and commented on? And I suppose I would be curious to hear your thoughts specifically on that.
I guess this is the question I'm grappling with as well. So part of me goes, it's totally natural and I totally understand that approach, in the sense that the arguments around that particular comment, for example, is that it is normalizing and legitimizing sexual assault against women, which is a pretty horrendous thing to do, and that
Yes.
by voting for or sort of or supporting that guy, you're normalizing and sexual assault against women, and that is an awful thing to do. And so I can understand that, but at the same time, I think that it's the there's an instinct around going that if you didn't think that that was the most important issue, then you're automatically a bad person who didn't who don't doesn't care about sexual assault or doesn't care about homophobic comments or things like that, and sort of a dismissing of all the other issues that are going on in an election and all the other issues that are going on in the world. And I think that that is also problematic, and I think that's the balance that I'm struggling with in many ways.
Do
Why
you think
is it?
that's, I mean, can you think of exact, do you think that's happened? Like where people have kind of, yeah, what you're saying, like that if you don't care about this, you're a terrible person?
Yeah, so I was reading an article just today. It was from a person, a queer person, I think bisexual identifying or maybe lesbian identifying. I'm not, I can't, it doesn't, either way, queer of some form. For example, writing something about, what was really interesting is that they were writing something saying, to their friends who are Donald Trump supporters, saying, well, you heard him say these homophobic things, and you still voted for him. You're voting against my family and my rights, and I just can't
Sure,
accept that.
sure. Yeah,
And
that's pretty direct.
Yeah, and that sort of thing was very, and I've seen that a little bit. I've seen that quite a bit, actually, to be fair. And what interests me is that it goes, okay, we've said that he's a homophobe, we've called him out, you must hate him now, but that your interests, and I think that in particular the economic interests of saying, well, people who there are definitely people who are voting for him because they feel economically under pressure, and there's no like consideration that economic issues are also family issues in many ways, or also issues about people's ability to survive and all of that sort of stuff.
Sure. I mean, that
And
kind of
sort of
goes
seeing
go oh, sorry, go ahead.
it's sort of seeing this sort of queer. I mean, in this instance, queer politics is very personal, and economic issues is very abstract. If that makes sense.
Sure. I mean, I feel like this is just the kind of classic thing that we talk about in terms of like the dichotomy, and I think it's possibly a false one between imagining. Yeah, I don't know. The kind of symbolic versus material stuff, the kind of identity versus economic stuff. And I suppose I don't have all that much interest in, like, I feel like people probably know where we stand on that sort of thing, and it would be to some degree a rehash of the kind of things we've already said. I suppose the reason that this is an interesting topic for me is, I mean, I should put it out that, like, I hate call-out culture. I really despise it, and it makes me often very angry. I think there's a kind of frustrating for me at least, irony in that I often have stronger emotional responses to responses around these sorts of things than I do to the things themselves, which is because I'm a cynical prick, I guess. Let's go with that.
You're not a prick.
But I just it does make me really angry, and
And I'm with you
for
on that.
sure. No, I suppose the it makes and it doesn't just make me angry for the kind of reasons of that I think it's less important, although that is part of it. I think it's also just that I think often it's a way. And we've talked about this a bit before as well, about identity politics kind of implying the existence of a sort of perfect political identity, that there is a hypothetical kind of person who is like who has quote unquote like good politics, like the best politics, and I think call-out culture can kind of often serve as a way for individuals to distance themselves from like shitty to kind of locate shitty behavior in certain kinds of people so that they don't or we don't have to think about it in ourselves. So if we kind of say, I know what a racist looks like Donald Trump, then I don't have to think about ways that I might be racist or might be kind of complicit in racist ideologies. And I think that's, hugely problematic, partly because it doesn't really create much possibility for change, but it's also like it also means that people are completely let off the hook for having to kind of critique their own behavior and their own participation in I don't know in society generally, and is absolutely kind of something that I think grows out of identity politics, which kind of grows out of neoliberalism in ways that we've talked about as well. This kind of focus on the individual as having this kind of abstract, self-contained identity distinct from like society, essentially.
I think you're right, and I think that the most interesting part for me about that is that it's not just about. Oh, I think the interesting part for me is that it's about what we target people in when in regards to call out culture. So what is it that we're calling out all the time? And what it is that we're calling out is speech. Normally, it is normally speech. It is
Yes.
normally things people say. It's someone who makes a homophobic comment or says something stupid or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it's very rarely actions or political actions that we call out. It is the speech and that you know, and the, and it is the you know the things that they say. So it's a really easy way to target an opposition, someone who we oppose or someone who we thought we liked, but then suddenly said something bad without actually looking at the actions, the real actions of the people that we like or that we support or that we want to support. So the perfect example I can think of this, and this goes back to the US election, is that there was, you know, heaps of calling out of Donald Trump in relation to his treatment, his comments around immigrants, for example. But very little criticism at the same time of, you know, and sorry, and a bunch of that calling out has been around him saying that he's going to deport, you know, all these illegal immigrants, he's going to have deportation squads, et cetera, et cetera. But at the same time, we haven't seen that sort of calling out to Barack Obama, who has, by estimates, over the past 8 years, deported like 2.5 million illegal immigrants back, you know, to Mexico, doing sort of implementing the very policy that Trump was talking about, because Barack Obama doesn't have the same language, the same crude racist language that someone like Donald Trump has. So it's a really easy way for us to call out an enemy, someone who's an enemy in inverted commas, without being able to look back at the people who we support and what they're actually doing and the physical things that they're doing and the things that, you know, and largely, you know, in terms of economic sense, the implementation of neoliberal policies that are occurring on all sides of the political spectrum in this instance. Does that make
Sure. I mean, I suppose I broadly agree. I think that I think it's a bit more complicated in the case of this US election, because I think like a lot of people, like by the end, a lot of people were really being quite explicit about the kind of like voting against Trump being a sort of harm minimization tactic. So, you know, when people were kind of having a go at Hillary, for example, people were like, it's not the same, and you know, like in a lot of ways it's not the same. And so I feel like that part of the discourse was at the forefront, that it wasn't so much a kind of lack of criticism of people that we maybe like more as it so much as it was a kind of like pick a side guys or whatever.
And I said, I'm actually thinking more. I was actually thinking more post the election, since when around the immigration stuff. But anyway, that was
Sure,
just
now
an
that Barack
example.
Obama's become like Jesus.
Yeah, exactly.
What else was I gonna say? No, I was just gonna say about the like language stuff. I mean, I think I don't think that we don't call out shitty behavior. I think we often do, but I mean, I suppose like language is I mean, you're right in that I think that's like often the focus and probably more often than not. And I think it kind of ties into what I was saying about the idea of kind of striving for this like perfect political self that's become a part of identity politics, in that like language is kind of easy because you can like I feel like in some ways like progressive politics have become basically just learning a list of positions to have on things, and learning a list of kind of language that we should use, and that if you do those things then you're a quote unquote good person. And it also then becomes an easy way to like identify who is not a good person, and which again I think is like largely about making people feel good about themselves. And you know, to some degree I go like, why the fuck not? I mean, you know, the world's awful, like we gotta take these things where we can. I think where I mean I'm being a bit facetious there. I think where I find this stuff really challenging, and particularly like post the election, is that you can kind of draw lines, and we've touched on this a bit before, between like people who are really invest. I mean, there are a lot of kind of like you know like identity politics wise privileged people who are engaging in this sort of practice, being you know like I don't know the like white heterosexual cisgendered men. But it's also there are a lot of people who kind of embody more kind of marginalized identity categories that engage in this stuff as well. And I think a lot of the discourse since the election has been, there's been like a kind of backlash to the sort of critiques that you and I might make by people of colour, for example, or by, I mean, that's, I suppose, where I've seen it the most, saying that that is a kind of critiquing kind of call-out culture and critiquing this kind of, like, focus on the symbolics of sort of language is something that comes from a, can only come from a place of privilege. And I think that there's some truth to that, and I, it kind of, it leaves me a bit discomforted, you know, to kind of go, like, our argument here is to some degree resting on an assumption of, like, false consciousness on the part of people, who are often, you know, again, under the terms of identity politics, kind of less privileged than we are.
Can you explain what you mean a bit more by the false consciousness bit? Just expand on that.
Well, that we're kind of saying that that people who kind of have these sorts of responses and focus on this sort of stuff, that they are making, that their responses are kind of rooted in maybe a less, like, kind of quote-unquote real view of the world than ours are, or a less material view of the world than ours are, which on some level is kind of quite arrogant.
Yeah, no, I can see what you're saying. And I think that's a potential reading of it. I would say, I think the challenge of call-out culture is that while I hate it, I really, really hate it, I also completely understand it, and that I can look at it and I say what you're saying, and I can see this reaction to stuff, and I can really understand why it occurs and why people react in the way they do, and I don't blame people, I guess is the best term I can come up with, for reacting in the way they do to these sorts of events occurring. I don't blame people for reacting the way they do, for example, for the, you know, the grab them by the pussy comment, I think this is, you know, my reading of it, you almost have a new outrage every week that sort of comes out. And I don't blame people for sort of getting into this cycle, and I can understand the reaction, particularly when you have this sort of histories of violence and oppression that build up on top of people, and then these are completely reasonable outbursts isn't the right term because that makes it sound irrational, but these are completely reasonable reactions to that process of occurring and seeing it publicly and having a space on place like social media to be able to react to it and to be able to really do that. I think the challenges for me is, well, is this the most reasonable is not the return, is this the best way to react to these sorts of things, and is it actually achieving the change that we want to achieve in the world? And I think when I step back and say, well, I step back and I say, no, I don't think it is, because I don't think it is actually creating any effective change. It is further, in my view, narrowing sort of our potential community of either of supporters or allies, because every time someone says something awful, they're sort of, my experience of watching this is that people automatically get ostracized. They say one thing, one comment, and they're judged by that for the rest of their career. And I had this total fear. I write stuff constantly, posting stuff on Facebook all the time, you know, and that is my career, and I am always terrified that I'm going to say the wrong thing one day and that I will automatically be out. Like, that's
totally
it.
And I have exactly the same fear. And we've talked about this before. I've had, like, literally had nightmares where I wake up and I go onto Twitter and everyone hates me and I don't know why.
And there's, you know, in that in that story, that guy's the So You've Been Publicly Shamed, they talk about this woman called Justine Sacco who made an insensitive joke about AIDS in Africa. She said, you know, going to Africa, I was looking this up before. She tweeted something that said, going to Africa, hope I don't get AIDS, just kidding, I'm white. Now, her explanation of it was that she was making a comment about racial politics and about the fact that white people are in a position of privilege in South Africa, but it just came across really awfully. But what happened to her is that she was literally, she tweeted that just before she was getting on a plane, and then she was on a plane for 12 hours, and by the time she was off the plane, she had no idea, but was literally like, she was trending on Twitter globally, was, you know, this is not a famous person, this is a random person. Globing, you know, that kind of stuff. I have those fears that's going to happen to me one day, and that I'm going to be that person. And I don't think that that is a useful response. It's an understandable response, but I don't think it's a useful response. I don't think it actually creates change. In fact, I think it creates significant backlash to the kinds of things we're achieving, and we're trying to achieve, or the kind of oppression we're trying to overcome, because it, you know, it's not actually engaging with people on why they're doing, why, you know, why what they've said is wrong, or why what we've said is insensitive, or what they've said is, you know, not helpful, or whatever we think about it, and instead just saying, you said this thing once, you're out, you're
It's also
done,
just
you're.
like a fucking horrible way to treat another human being. Like,
Yeah.
and you know, there's obviously like a huge gap here between. Like, I feel like we shouldn't kind of compare. We're not talking about Trump here, you know. Like that's something different, you know. And obviously, he's like a public figure. The stakes are much higher, but you know, in cases like that, and they're often like people, even if they are public figures, who really, I think. You know, where the stakes are pretty low. I think, like, at, you know, best case scenario, it's like not achieving any change. Worst case scenario, you're like, you know, ruining someone's life. And sort of somewhere in, and across all of that, again, I just have that extreme discomfort that to me, it's just primarily about, like objectifying and othering people that we. That represent something perhaps in ourselves that we don't like. And that just I just find that really gross. You know, I was just thinking about this something that happened recently, and it was just one of those things. Like I try I usually don't I can usually pick my battles pretty well on social media, and I just kind of stay away from things because I just hate it so much. But there was this thing that happened recently, like a few weeks back. Where a young guy who used to be a columnist for the Star Observer, actually, funnily enough, which you and I, Simon, both have at various points been, and he wrote an article like years ago when he was very young. He was like 19 or something like that when he wrote it, called "I'm a Sexual Racist" or
Yeah,
something
I think I've
like
heard the
that.
story, but you can keep going, yeah.
Yeah, so he basically wrote this article where he said, I mean, it's pretty appalling. I mean, it's basically just him saying like sexual racism is a thing. Like, I just have certain preferences. There are like I prefer to have sex with, you know, this kind of person or whatever. And what's wrong with that? Like, how is that any different from, you know, I don't know.
Liking tall dudes or liking whatever.
Totally, which is something we have actually addressed in a podcast before, which I think
It
is
is.
was a very good a good discussion. But I mean, look, it's like just straight up a pretty horrible article. Like it's not good, and I would never want to defend it. I think that absolutely it shouldn't have been published, and I think that there was some kind of failure of duty of care to this very, very young writer who it should have been pretty clear was going to cop a lot of flack over publishing this thing. Anyway. Fast forward like 4 or 5 years or whatever it's been, he's like running for the board of the Mardi Gras, Sydney Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras, very high profile position. Somebody, I don't know how it came up, but you know, I wouldn't be surprised if somebody dredged it up deliberately. This article came up. He ended up being forced to kind of respond to it and say, you know, I don't, I regret it, blah 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 blah. But it just like some of the stuff I was seeing in the days after that. After that happened, just like absolutely just groups of people just shitting on this still young guy who was even younger when he did this thing that he now regrets, kind of going, oh, how much can someone change in 5 years? Like, how real is this apology? And I just found the whole thing so kind of so disgusting and like just absolutely representative of all these things I'm. That we're saying are kind of shitty about call out culture and that it achieved nothing. It was surely not a kind of fun experience for this guy to go through. And then, you know, I think says more about the people doing it than it does about him. I stupidly commented on a comment thread about this, and I think the like first lines in my comment were like, "I'm gonna regret this," but, and then I did, and I ended up just deleting the comment. But it was just basically, I just had this kind of tirade, which I really never do on social media, where I'm just like, "This is horrible," like, you know, this guy did something when he was really young, blah blah blah. And all these people started having a go at me, basically saying, like, don't police our responses, like, don't police, like, our kind of emotional responses to this, blah, 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 blah. This is actually really important. And so I just kind of deleted my comment. But I was really kind of confronted by that, in that I find it really hard to find a kind of middle ground between saying, I do think that this behavior is really shitty, but, like, validating the emotional place that these responses are coming from.
Yeah, and I don't know how to achieve that. And I think it's challenging because I do think that, as I said before, I think that these responses are understandable, and make total sense. And yet I find them so, and this is, I remember reading about this particular story. And seeing people making those comments of, oh, it's just a fake, he's just trying to cover up his real beliefs, all that kind of stuff, you know, so that he could get this board position. And I found that really gross, as you did. You know, the very idea that you can, you know, you said something when you were really young. Oh, even when you said something when you were really old, I don't really care when you said it.
Sure.
And then you regretted it, so you realized, you know, some people provided feedback maybe, and then you went, oh, actually, now I've thought about this a lot more. Actually, that was not right. And you go, okay, I'm gonna try and set the record straight and say that that was not right. And still, everything what you said 5 years ago is held against you. Like, and I just don't find it useful in any way, shape, or form. And even though I find it under, even though I understand it, and that is the struggle I have with this, in like, how do you challenge the culture, a culture that I find extremely unuseful, whilst understanding why people engage in that process? And I don't know. I don't know the correct answer to that, except for to say, you know, there are more constructive ways to deal with this than the way we're dealing with this sort of stuff.
Well, I feel like that kind of leads really nicely into the final question that you had kind of posited in the kind of list of questions we have for this episode, which I think is a really great one, and sort of flips that around a bit and asks, you know, does rejecting call-out culture, as it sounds like we're doing, just give license for people to be homophobic, racist, and sexist? And do we have an alternative?
So no, I don't think it does. I don't think it does. And but maybe I have to say that because I'm sure there are people who would say it does give people license to being homophobic, racist, and sexist, or bigot, you know, have bigot, you know, say bigoted things in any way, their shape or form. I don't think that rejecting call-out culture means that people don't have to be accountable for their statements and their actions. I just think that there are more constructive ways for people to be accountable. And I think that maybe the best sort of, like, the really micro level stuff of this is, I often see, you know, I'm a member of a number of Facebook groups around political stuff. And I often see people who will make a comment, oh, about something, will say something, and then you see people just pile on really, really quickly. Without, and I often wonder, I wonder if anyone has actually messaged or called that person to have a conversation with them about why what they just said was maybe not the right thing, or was maybe considered offensive to particular people. Did anyone actually engage with that person as a person, or did they automatically label them as an awful person who needed to be called out? Did anyone realize that maybe they just made a mistake, or they didn't understand that their language was occur, you know, that language was offensive to particular people? Did, you know, what was, you know, what do we, you know, why? It sort of goes to that thing where you were saying before about, like, creating the ideal person with the ideal politics. And the moment that you're not that ideal person, you're automatically labeled as the opposite of that, almost. And that you're
Sure,
not,
there are
you know.
good people and there are bad people.
Yeah, and so the moment you say one bad thing on social media, you're one of the bad people, and so you just deserve to be called out for that, and there's no redeeming you. And I don't think that that is a valuable proposition. And I actually think that if we actually engaged in processes where we said, you know, had conversations with people that said, hey, this is why you know, why we, you know, why we think what you said or what you did was not right. Here is some sort of process. It might not change their mind. You don't, I don't know, but I think it's more constructive than automatically labeling them as a bad person and pushing them out of the tent, I
Sure.
guess. Of the potential good people.
I mean, I think, two things I would say. I think a lot of this goes to like the fact that it's no coincidence that this stuff all happens on social media, where I think often, we have access to the opinions of all of these people, a lot of whom we don't really know very well, and so I can imagine that in a lot of cases the relationships that would need to the kind of connection that would need to be there to support that sort of an action, sending someone a direct message or giving someone a ring, si simply don't exist. In that, like you're probably unlikely to be fighting with your best friend about this stuff on Facebook, for example. So I think that, that's worth saying. I think it's also just worth saying that, like, just thinking about the kind of wording of that question, and that it sort of plays into this idea that if we don't hear people saying sexist, racist, or homophobic things, then there is no sexism, racism, and homophobia. And it's kind of like, well, I mean, there is. It's about more than like people saying bad stuff on the internet. It is present in all parts of society and in all people, I think, to some degree. Women can be sexist, gay men can be homophobic, for example. And so I think there is a lot of value in just acknowledging that and kind of like holding the fact that these things, this behavior that we try to sort of excise from ourselves is. We're not going to be able to do that, that it's there, that it's there, it's in society, and we have to some degree acknowledge that, even as we fight to change it.
And I think you've just I know we're getting to the end, so I won't go into this too much, but you've just sort of sparked something in my head a little bit, in which I think that, you know, the thought process I'm having right now is that I think that the way we talk about sexism, homophobia, and racism now almost solely sees them as actions of speech and nothing more. And I think that almost, not quite the same, but it's very focused on speech and very focused on things people say and not so much on as much on what people do. And I sort of talked about this before in the sense that, you know, the example that popped into my head was, you know, no one, for example, would call Julia Gillard a sexist, even though on the same day that she part, you know, she made her famous misogyny speech, she passed rules that, you know, she passed cuts to welfare for single parents, right?
Yes.
But the focus was on the speech and not necessarily on the actions of what her government was doing, and there was sort of the dis a dis disconnect between sexist policy and, or you know, or just policy and her speech or that sort of stuff. And I think that
Yes, it's
occurs
quite a
quite.
stark example.
Yeah, that occurs quite regularly where people can be forgiven for speech or can be blamed for things they say whilst ignoring the policy things that they're trying to implement or the things that they propose or all of that sort of stuff. And it becomes, I guess what's happening is it's really easy to target speech, but it's much harder to actually engage with the sort of difficult policy issues that one could label as easily sexist when, or when, you know, but others just say, well, this is just economic policy, for example. I don't know where I'm just, it was just a thought bubble, but I'm just one
No,
which
sure.
sparked in my
And
head.
it's also I think we should also kind of resist like putting those two thi like putting those things in sort of two separate camps. I mean, I think it's they're absolutely interrelated. But yeah, the point is more that we do only focus on one bit.
Or that I think that people are actively putting them into two separate camps, which I don't think they should be. And so we focus on the speech when
Sure,
the
sure.
material, and this goes back to what we've been talking about a lot, we focus on the symbolic when the material is being ignored. And I think the call-out culture is actually a really good good illustration of that, where we focus on what people are saying, and ignore the things that they're doing, the material things that they're doing.
We might finish up there. So that's it for us today. Thank you for listening, and we will be back with another episode, hopefully, in 2 weeks. It won't be
Yeah,
quite
I
so
think we're
long,
both
but.
in the country, so that's good. Yay! Well, in the meantime, you can catch us on queers.podomatic.com or subscribe to us on iTunes. And of course, please leave us a review and a rating. It always helps other people find us, and we really appreciate it.
And tell everyone else to do it as well, because, that would be helpful. You can also find us in the meantime on Twitter. I am at Ben C. Riley.
And I'm at Simon Copland, and you can also catch me on Facebook at Simon Copland Writer.
That's all for us today, and we will see you next time.
See you later.